It is my privilege today, it is really my privilege today to introduce this tall, dark, handsome, sorry he's taken, Victor M. from Kingston, Ontario.
My name is Victor, I'm from Imperial Isle, and I think I'm at the wrong meeting. My name is Victor, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, when they asked me to come here, I thought it was just going to be a few people. Was the mall closed? Don't you have some place to go? You know, I'm like most alcoholics. I came to AA because I wanted to. I came like most people. I had jewelry, an escort, a driver. You know, what more could a guy want? I had a single room, bars in the front. I came to AA because I was sent. Northern Ontario, that's where I'm from. Wawa, the land of the big goose. Don't applaud too long. We only have 20 minutes. Okay. I was born and raised in Northern Ontario, the only town that applauded when I left. I sobered up in Wawa, Ontario, and moved to Kingston in 1983, and lived happily ever after. You know, when I came to AA, in the small town that I grew up with, I didn't know anything about AA. Somebody mentioned to me one time, and so I just blew it off and said, yes, that's if I want to learn to drink, I will go there. Right now, I'm doing quite well. You know, I had a job. I was working for Algoma Steel, and I thought I was doing quite well. And everybody else around me seemed to be getting upset more and more. The more I drank, the more upset they got. I invented the four-day week. I invented the short pay. I didn't realize there was bigger pay until I sobered up. You know, I look at it now, Algoma Steel, when they said, Victor, we're sending you to AA, I thought, what the hell is it? And it was a Friday afternoon, and they said, the police will come and pick you up and take you down to the police station because there's no meeting until Sunday. And see, I found out after, they can't do that. But in Wawa, they can. And so I remember going to my first AA meeting. I remember Sunday morning the police let me out of the back seat because they didn't put no handles there yet. And I went into my first meeting. I walked up to the door. I opened it, and there they were. A whole room full of old bastards. You know, I said to them, you know, if I was your age, I would have stopped drinking too. Because I think one more drink would have killed him anyway. You know, and I looked at that. I was 29 years old. What the hell am I doing in here? 29 years old. This old guy says, Victor, what are you doing here? I said, I'm here because Algoma Steel sent me. They said, why don't you sit down and shut up? Like, I think you can sue them for that now. You know, at that time, you couldn't. You sat down and you shut up. And they told you to stay that way for a year. And, you know, they talked about the stuff that I thought of. Feelings, hurts, angers, frustration. See, I knew hurt and anger. If I was holding you by the throat and your feet weren't touching the floor, I was angry. I was kind of spiritual. You could come to me and actually limp away. You know, that's the kind of guy I was. You know, Algoma Steel said, Victor, you're going to AA. Because it was a union and a company agreement, I got paid $20 an hour for my first meeting. Second meeting, third meeting. Went on for 3 months. Jesus, I was getting those long-winded speakers. God, I love them. Extra $20. And that's all you were buying was coffee. So that was... You know, I went to those meetings for 3 months. I was sober for 3 months. God, I was doing well for 3 months. I was actually thinking. Which is very scary for alcoholics. Don't do that because you're not equipped. This guy was telling me last night about, he says, what's a shih tzu? I said, it's a little dog. He said, no, it's a zoo with no animals. You know, I learned things here in AA. That's where my material comes from, is AA. I was sober for 3 months, going to AA, going to the meeting, sitting beside, you know, the guy that hated me. I sat right in front of him every meeting. And, you know, after 3 months, they said, Victor, we're going to give you a medallion. I said, what for? They said, for staying sober for 3 months. I said, what? You get a medallion for staying sober. Wish they had medallions for being drunk. You know, I would have had a cast iron car. You know, I started late in life. Hey, I was about 10 when I first started serious drinking. Because, you know, my dad used to make a brew down in the basement, and you used to put your head in it. You know, as you put your head and sipped, it got lower. Then your hair went in, and with malt, malt is kind of gluey. So my dad could tell if we were drinking because our hair sort of stood out the front. I was sober in AA for 3 months. You people that's dyslexic will be able to follow me because I go back and forth. The rest of you is just go on. I'll catch up to you. Okay. 3 months sober, getting a medallion. I went to bed that night. I went to sleep. 3 o'clock in the morning, boom, I woke up. I said, holy shit. Holy doo-doo. Okay. Sorry. The guy doing it. Okay. I was getting a medallion for staying sober for 3 months. I woke up in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden, I'm sober. I don't know how to be sober. I don't know what sober feels like. I don't know what sober is. So I went and seen the old guys, and I said, you guys look kind of comfortable. After 3 months, they started to look comfortable. I said, how do you guys stay sober? Comfortable. I'm not comfortable. And they said, why don't you go to your treatment center? I said, they have a treatment center for this stuff? And they said, yeah. I said, where is it? Thunder Bay. So I went to Thunder Bay. I went to Thunder Bay. First, I went to work, and I told my boss, again, alcoholics never ask a question unless they already have an answer. Just for news, for newcomers. Okay. I went to my boss and I said, I've been sober for 3 months. And he laughed. And he says, what do you want to do? I said, I want to go to Smith Clinic in Thunder Bay. And he said, well, what the hell is that for? I said, for alcohol treatment. He said, well, you were sober for 3 months. I said, yeah, but I'm not comfortable sober. And so he said, okay. I knew there was a waiting list. He knew there was a waiting list. Everybody else knew there was a waiting list. So he phoned Friday afternoon. He phoned Thunder Bay. Noon. Underground. I'm mining. I come out for lunch. Phone call. Victor, come to the surface. Ooh. See, I know because I opened my big mouth, asked for something, and they read my file. They know what happened. They know where those machines went. They know something happened. See, I used to repair machinery underground. And if I couldn't get it running right, I took it home. Then I got it running right. Then I got it running real good. Then I sold it. It was no good anyway. You know. But if you were short some steel, I got that from the mine because they didn't really need it because they had lots. And bits and stuff I used to steal from the mine. And so I went into the office, I kicked the door open, I said, what do you want? He said, Victor, Smith Clinic's going to take you. Oh, Jesus. I said, when? They said, this afternoon. I said, I can't go this afternoon, I have no money. And they said, how much you need for a 28-day program? I said, $7,000. He wrote me a check. I said, I can't go, my wife doesn't know. And they said, your stuff is going to be on the side of the road. Just drive by and pick it up. Algoma Steel at that time had an airplane in Wawa, and so they said the plane will fuel up and fly you to Thunder Bay. Now, this thing is going awful fast for somebody that really was thinking of going to treatment. When I got in the back of the plane, I started to think, and if you're an alcoholic, don't do this. I started to think. And I thought, you know, in Thunder Bay, there must be somebody who really needs this program. I have 7,000 bucks in the back of my pocket, and I'm feeling like Victor Newman. And I said, you know, there's got to be somebody up there that really needs it. I'll pay him $1,000 to go to AA, to the program. I'll sit in the hotel and suffer. Then 28 days, he'll come out. We'll live happily ever after, and who the hell would know the difference? So, you know, when an alcoholic gets a thought like that, he just, oh, man, this is wonderful. And so that's what I went with. I went up to Thunder Bay. The plane landed. I got off the plane. I went to a taxi cab, put all my stuff in the back. And I said, I want to go as close to the Smith Clinic as I can get. I'm a couple of days early. I went Monday morning. I want to be there. I'll wait at the hotel right across the street until Monday. The guy said, the cab driver said, I just got out of there. They'll take you early. I'm on my way to a treatment center. I have stuff in my bag that I really need. You know that Aqua Velva when the meeting is really not going well? You drink it and they'll throw you out. I knew that. They took it away from me. They took my toothpaste. They gave me something alcohol-free. You ever try to brush your teeth with alcohol-free toothpaste? You just... Anyway, I went through the program. 28 days, they said, read this, read that, read this, do that, do this, that. So I did it all because I knew you'd get out of my face. So I did it all. And if you want to stay sober, don't do it. I did it. And I was still sober 27 days into the program. Victor, come to the office. Holy Jesus. You know, I went down to the office, kicked the door open. I said, I don't know whose room she was in. It's not my bottle. What do you want? And they said, your father died. We're sending you back home. And so, you know, I said, how am I going to stay sober? I've been sober for 4 months now. The counselor said, here's your medallion. The plane's coming to pick you up. You've got to go home. And so I went home. And he said, don't drink and go to meetings. Oh, God, isn't that scientific? You know, the greatest thing you ever heard? You know, after being sober for 4 months and your father died? Like, Jesus. You know, because I was going to make amends to my father. Because I didn't treat my father well. I didn't treat my mother well. I didn't treat my family well. There was 10 of us kids born in that family. And I had 5 sisters and I wore hand-me-downs, eh? I could use those bras now. But I went home. I went home, buried my father, I went back to AA, and I started to resume a normal life. And, I'd done everything I was supposed to do. God, I was doing well. And I started to get promotions, and I started to get, you know, things were going well. Then Algoma Steel says, we're going to lay off 1,500 people. And I said, oh, my God, that's going to be bad for some of these people. Just got their wives back. I just gave them back. You know, some people just had new trucks. Some people had new cars, and they were going to suffer. And my buddy said, Chick, Victor, I don't know why you're all upset. You're on the layoff list. And so I ran down to AA, and I said, what the hell kind of company is this? You know, the AA guys, I said, Jesus, they sober me up, and now they lay me off. What the hell's the matter with them? You know that old guy? He said, don't worry, things will get better. God, I wanted to rip his face off. I said, what the hell am I going to do? I'm the top miner here. He said, not Lamar. And so I waited for 3 months for something to happen in Algoma Steel. It never happened. And I thought a machine would go down one of the holes and they'd have to come and get me because I knew how to take them out. They didn't come get me. And so after 3 months, I said to my wife, I said, you know, I'm going to go to the Sioux and look for a job, which is 142 miles down the highway. It's much further now because it's metric. It's over 200 and something now. Much. Well, you know, it's a long ways. So I went to Sault Ste. Marie when it was just a little short distance, 3 hours. And, you know, being an alcoholic, I got a job at a police station working in a jail. Being an alcoholic, I applied at the university as a counselor, and I got that job. So I had two jobs and a little apartment. I was set. And, you know, I spent some time in a priesthood. It wasn't a priesthood. The priest went there, and we went there as bad kids. It was like a priesthood. And so, anyway, I went there. And they taught us some stuff, you know, that I thought, well, because I'm living by myself, I'll practice some of this stuff, like celibacy. And so I practiced it for 2 weeks. And you know, when an alcoholic gets lonely, where does he go? Where does he go to find people? At the bar. So I went down to the bar. There she was sitting on a stool ready to fall off. I said, how would you like to come and live with me? She said, okay. And so I took her home. And for 2 weeks, oh God, it was lovely. She was Chinese, eh? I never went out with Chinese girls. You put your stuff, your cigarette in the ashtray. You used to smoke at that time. Put it in the ashtray. Back clean. Oh God, that's nice. And you know those little things when you're living alone, they start to grow in the fridge? Those little furry things with the little black hairs on them? I don't know what the hell they are, but it was living in my fridge. It was doing quite well until she came, killed it. And I had this other thing. You know, under the bed, you know, you have those little tumbleweeds? Or they're dust bunnies. Mine were the big ones, tumbleweeds. She got rid of all them. God, it was a nice little place I had there. Then she said, my brother's coming, and my dad and my mother's coming to live with us. And I said, no boat, everybody out. And by that time, I was used to throwing people out. I was getting kind of good at it. And so I went down to the bar. After 2 weeks of celibacy, it wasn't working again, so I got lonely, and I went down to the bar, and there she was, sitting on the stool, ready to fall off. I said, how would you like to come live with me? She said, okay. And you know, it was an Indian woman. You know, I've been an Indian all of my life. My mother and father was like, what did you think, I was Chinese? Huh? Northern Ontario, and I love to work. That's what threw you off. So she came to live with me. 2 weeks. God, it was beautiful. Oh, it was nice. Then her brother came to live with us. Then I came back from school one day. Everybody was drunk. And so I went down to my AA buddies. And I told them, I discovered something. If you pick up a girl in the hotel, chances are she drinks. I learned that. And I added a little piece. If you find somebody on a golf course, chances are they play golf. I added that from being sober for over 5 years. I learned that. And so I said, tomorrow, you and your brother be gone. And they were gone. Her and her brother was gone. The TV was gone. The VCR was gone. My little bunch of cooking utensils were gone. Anything that fit in the pillowcase was gone. So I phoned the police. Mr. Lawman, I phoned the police. And I said, I've been robbed. They said, who is this? I said, Victor McCoy. And they said, how do you like it? me and the police got along real well because he knew me by my first name. I knew him by Chief. And, you know, like, we had a few little run-ins. I got a few minutes. I'll tell you about one. We were sitting in a hotel one night, and this guy said, I can peel a safe. And I said, what the hell do you mean you can peel a safe? He says, I can blow the front right off it. And I said, I just happen to know where there is a safe. And in Northern Ontario, every Wednesday, they go out and they put the money into the safe. On the Thursday, the train picks it up, takes it to Sault Ste. Marie, and brings back whatever they do. They do it. And so I knew that was there. And so I said to my buddy, I said, what do we need? He said, I need some powder. I work underground. I need caps. I work underground. He said, we need a little detonator and some wire. I said, I work underground. And so I went to work that night, and I put powder in my thermos. I put the cap on, put it in my lunch belt, walked out. Nobody said nothing. Nobody even knew it was missing. So the next day, I put the wires in the cap in my thermos, walked right out of the mine. The next day, I just threw the little cranker. I just threw it right in the lunch pail, walked right out the door. Nobody said nothing. So he said, on Wednesday, we'll do it. And this was Tuesday. And so I was driving around the little town of Wawa with my little truck with enough powder to blow the whole town right off the map. And drinking and driving and having a great time. Because it wasn't against the law there. By my standards. And so anyway, we went down to the hotel. First, you know, we had a couple of drinks. Alcoholics only have a couple. I had a couple. And my friend came in. He had a couple. My other friend came in. We had a couple more. Then all of a sudden, the door opened and the light shone, and there he comes, the guy that knows how to peel the safe. He said, Victor, I'm going to have a drink, then we'll do it. I said, okay, right on. So we went out to the big safe, and it was in a building. And about every 200 years, they clean these buildings. This one hasn't been cleaned for 150 years. So we pried the door. It wouldn't come open. So I just happened to have a bar in the back of my truck, and it fell open. You know, we just pushed it a little bit too hard, and it fell open. And so we went in. And, you know, like, I'm proud of the way I work. And so he said, do you know how to wire this if I tell you? I said, yeah, I work underground. I know how to. So he said, put a little bit on. What's a little bit to an alcoholic? It didn't look like enough. So I put a little bit more. And I wired the whole thing, and God, it was beautiful. We had to stand back and have a drink. And so we had a couple. Then we wired it, and my buddy says, Jesus, we're pretty close. I said, okay, move back two more pillars. So we moved back two more pillars. Boom! And if you ever stood in the barrel of a gun, you know what I'm talking about. It was the biggest blast that I ever heard. There was 150 years of dust fell down. And there's five guys standing in the dust saying, holy Jesus. And you know when you're half drunk and your ears are ringing? And my buddy's saying, I see the door. And the door blew right off the safe. The door was actually laying there. But the air was leaving the room a little bit faster than we thought. And we looked in the office, and there was a hole through the office. There was a hole through the end of the office. There was my truck sitting out in the parking lot next to the safe. I said to my buddy, let's go. And so we left there, five of us in the cab of the truck. 7,000 people that came from the town heard the blast. And up north, when you hear a big explosion, you go to it. And the people that caused it leave. And so we were sitting in the hotel. I said, don't sit together, they'll know. We're covered with 150 years of dust. We're sitting there drinking draft beer. We look like Al Jolson. A highly trained officer came in and said, you, come with me. I think that's what he said. That's what appeared that he said. I got charged for breaking entry, willful damage, possession of stolen goods, theft over, theft under, and we never even seen in the box. we paid restitution to have the building tightened up. It was a little loose after we were done. We paid restitution to have the walls repaired. And Victor was the instigator. I went to jail. I'd like to say I learned something. I didn't learn a damn thing. And I went to jail again because I sold the house that I was renting. And you know when you're drinking and you got a good deal? Don't let it go. Follow it through. I followed it through. I paid restitution for that too. And I think I had holidays that time for 6 months. 18 months the first time, 6 months the second time. When I took the machine, they needed a bus out in Long Lac. And so I knew they were painting the bus and they wouldn't look at it till spring. So I took it during the winter. They wouldn't know it was missing until summer. And so who cared? They didn't need it. And so I took it to Long Lac and sold it. Got caught for that too. You know, I was a good drinker. But I got into a lot of trouble with it. And you know, I'd like to say that normal things happen to normal people. Abnormal people, abnormal things. That's kind of going together. You know, I was in AA, and the guy said, sit down and shut up. You know, that was the first time I ever started to listen. And, you know, 5 years later, you know, they're giving me a cake and a bunch of stuff for staying sober. And, you know, like that today still scares me. And, you know, being asked to come here to speak to this many people has got to be some kind of a gift for a little fat Indian from up north who thinks he's tall, dark, and handsome. I've been working for 23 years in Kingston. I work in Collins Bay Penitentiary as a Native Liaison Officer. A month ago, they hired me full time. You know, and you know, the guys come and see me and they say, Victor, you don't understand. And I say, no, you're talking to the wrong guy. If you think you're the first guy to ever sit in that cell, you're wrong. This used to be mine. Look at Toronto. This used to be mine. I am the previous landholder. My life is good because of you people. I have a wife that loves me. I have kids that love me. And I have friends that'll put me up for the night. My friend Tom, he came and picked me up last night, took me down to his place in Hamilton, or Burlington, or wherever it is, over there. You know, like it for the Indian people. I love what I do, and I'm glad I had a chance to do it for you. Thank you.
Now that is my version of tall, dark, and handsome. You having fun? Yeah. I'm having so much fun, I almost forgot about that 24-hour, used to be 5-hour flight I took. You know, and I don't really mind anymore that they locked my luggage for 3 days. You know? I've been taught by my sponsor that when things go wrong, you should go out and help someone. And my sponsor wasn't here, and I thought, what would Shirelli do? What would she tell me to do? She told me to be of service. So what I did is I took my credit card downtown, and I was of service to all the retail stores. And I'm sure my sponsor will tell me I did the exact right thing. This is a great meeting we're having today, and our next speaker, our lady speaker, Jeannie V from Kingston. No, she's from the mainland of New Zealand. Jeannie, come share with us.
Hi, everyone. My name's Jeannie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a rest because my cheeks are so sore from listening to the last guy. You can't carry on like that for an hour and a half. I was very fortunate, I went down to the San Diego International Convention, and the rooms there, held about 100, 150 people. And I thought, when I was asked to speak here, I could probably manage that. And then I went on the website last week and I saw 3500 after this room, and I thought, goodness. Or thoughts to that effect. That must be a misprint. Holy hell, it's not. But isn't it awesome? Look at you guys, all sober and all made the effort to get here, and that is just neat. That is great. I am so, so lucky. I've got a word up here that I try to live by. I don't do it as well as I'd like to, but I try to live by it. First sentence of chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I am so lucky that I have had sponsors in my journey through this fellowship, my journey from madness to gladness. My first sponsor was a most handsome, tall Maori lady in New Zealand. She was actually a World Service delegate, Elsie. And I can remember once at an assembly, a big assembly in New Zealand, maybe 200 people, Elsie had gone through some personal tragedies like you wouldn't believe. She was sitting at the back trying to be quiet, trying to absorb, and they picked her to speak. She came down through the hall in a scarlet frock, and she came down so serenely. She was talking to her higher power on the way up to the stage. I learnt from that, you're never alone. I've got my higher power with me here today. My second sponsor, my sponsor today, I rang her when I saw the 3500 on the net. I thought, oh shit. I rang Shirley in Auckland, and she said, you'll be all right, darling. They're just friends you haven't met. Isn't that neat? That is neat. That really is. I've also got brain damage. I can't remember a damn thing. I work by lists. I work by pieces of paper. Now that is the first piece, and I've done it. Okay? We're on to two. Healing through laughter. Now, if you're hoping to hear a whole series of dirty jokes here, you're not going to. I am the world's worst joke teller. I am hopeless, so we'll skip that one. But I had a funny thing happen yesterday. This is as true as I stand here. The guy might be in this room. Do you know, I was young once. And when I was young, I had all the bits in the right places. And I knew how to show them off. And I used to get quite a few comments, and I sort of purred when I got the comments. We're standing at the intersection yesterday, and there was a man standing next to me, and he looked at my tag and he said, oh, New Zealand, I love your lamb. People used to say, I love your buns, or I love your tits, or something, but they've never looked at me. Thank God he didn't say, I love your mutton, you know. Now, as I said, I'm from New Zealand. Several people have said to me, how long does it take to get here? Okay, I'll tell you. We took 4.5 hours from San Francisco, and from there you get on a plane, and you head out, and you miss Hawaii, and you head down over Tahiti, Fiji, Samoa, you keep going. You give a big wide berth to our cousins in Australia. You keep going towards the Antarctic, and just before you get there, there are two beautiful islands, and that's New Zealand. It's about 12 hours from San Francisco. Down there, we've got 60 million sheep. and we've got 4 million people. It's the quality, not the quantity, that counts, buddy. Who have we got down there? Okay, who won the New Zealand? Who won the U.S. Open last week? Michael Campbell from New Zealand. Who was the first person to climb Mount Everest? Sir Edmund Hillary from New Zealand. Where does Rachel Hunter come from? New Zealand. Now, all you Brits in the congregation here, last night our All Black team cleaned up the British Isles 48-18. Yoo-hoo! Who was the second country to ever take the America's Cup away from America? New Zealand. Ever heard of it? You have now. I tell you the other thing, we've got several thousand full-blown alcoholics down there, and we've got several thousand alcoholics in recovery down there, and we've got great recovery down there. AA is alive and well in New Zealand, and I am forever grateful to Bill and Dr. Bob for what they left us, for the steps they left us, the traditions they left us, the structure they left us. Without them and the principles like giving it away to keep it, I wouldn't be standing in front of you today. There's a little bit in the big book on page 133. We are sure God would like to see us happy, joyous and free. Hence, we cannot subscribe to the belief that this life necessarily has to be a veil of tears, though it once was just that for many of us. But it became clear that most of the time we made our own misery. A little bit of my story. I've been around the fellowship, I'm in my 25th year now. And we're talking about laughter. I've had lots and lots of different sorts of laughter. When I was thinking about this topic, I've had carefree laughter, I've had happy laughter, I've had embarrassed laughter, I've had loud laughter, I've had cruel laughter, I've had years with no laughter. Now I'm back to the happy laughter again. I came from quite a small family. I'm one of one. They either looked at me and said, we can't improve on this, or they looked at me and said, oh God, we're not doing that again. I'm not sure which way it was. But I came from a very gentle family. My father was away at the Second World War when I was born. I was 2 and a half when he got back. There was alcohol in the family. My parents drank. There was a lot of partying, but it was happy, happy laughter, happy parties. Mum was a wonderful woman. Dad, I found out when I came through the doors of AA, I've got your dyslexia problem, I go backwards and forwards too. When I came through the doors of AA, I realised that my father had been an alcoholic, but I didn't know any different. He was just Dad, and he'd come home and sometimes he'd cause a row and he'd get in the car and he'd go off again, and I thought that was quite normal. Then I went to boarding school, one of these exclusive church boarding schools, and I think it was at that stage that I found out that I was a little different. I can remember at the age of 14 coming home and discovering alcohol at a party. Well, I wanted that alcohol, and I stole it. I stole some Bacardi, some rum, and I put the rum in Coke bottles, and I took it back to boarding school. Now, in those days, boarding school was fairly darn strict. So what to do with it when I got to boarding school? Now, if you've got an upright piano, down below the keyboards, that board behind the pedals, you can actually remove it. Now, you can stack Coke bottles in there and then put it back again. But don't put them too close together, because if somebody who's not in the know starts to play the piano, they rattle. So you've got to space them out. Now, I don't think anybody else at the boarding school did that. I needed that alcohol, I took it to school, and I drank it at school. And when I could get other alcohol, right from the word go, I drank it. Done that one. We had a lot of laughter at boarding school. It was happy laughter, carefree laughter. A lot of good friends that I've still got today. I went trained as a teacher afterwards, and I can remember getting into a certain amount of strife at that stage. I'd been to a boarding school of one religion, and then I actually belonged to another religion, and I decided after boarding school I would teach Sunday school, for whatever reason, I don't know. But when you've only got a bicycle as a means of transport, you're 18 years of age, you go out on the piss on Saturday night to try to find your way to the Sunday school, to get home, get cleaned up, get on your bike, literally, find your way to the Sunday school and then teach Sunday school is quite a marathon effort. And I used to play the piano at the Sunday school. And these kids singing, Jesus loves me, this I know. When you've got a hangover. That lasted about 3 months. After I'd been teaching for a few years, I did my OE, I went overseas. Now, in those days, in the 60s, the only way to get from New Zealand to Britain was by boat. You couldn't afford to fly. So we had 5.5 weeks on a ship. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo. And at the end of the year, it sort of filled up with young people. And then we went to Aussie and we picked up a few more young people, like several hundred. And we drank our way to Britain. And by the time we got to the Bay of Biscay, off the coast of Spain there, we had drunk the ship dry. Not a bad effort. In those years in Europe, that year in Europe, I started to have blackouts. It was, I guess, the beginning of the end. My laughter changed here. It changed from the carefree laughter sometimes to that strained laughter. When people the next day say to you, you remember last night when such and such, and you haven't got a clue, and you laugh, and it's forced laughter, because you really don't remember what happened, where you were, how you got home, or who with. I came back to New Zealand, I got married. Now, we had no children, we had no responsibility, there seemed to be plenty of money, there was heaps of booze. We partied long, and we partied hard, and it didn't. We just did it. I can remember one night, we used to go to a lot of balls, I think you call them formals in the States. All dressed up to the nines, long frocks, jewellery, the whole nine yards. Came home from a ball one night. I didn't want to go to bed. Find somebody to stay up and drink with me. I found a young man who would stay up, sit round the fireplace, drink with me. He drank with me till about 6 in the morning. Then I had a good idea. We had a goat. So I suggested to this fellow that we took the goat for a walk. So, not in my ball shoes, I couldn't. So I went out in my ball frock, my long frock, and put my gumboots on. And I went down the road in front of all the neighbours at 6 in the morning with my ball frock, my gumboots, and a strange man in tow with half a tuxedo on. And, you know, I didn't think the neighbours knew I drank. My laughter changed after this. My laughter got louder, and I laughed at crude jokes. If men were telling dirty jokes, I laughed loud. I was one of the boys. I figured I could drink them under the table so I could laugh with them. It wasn't the way I'd been brought up. I started going downhill. The lies started. I had to lie. I couldn't remember where I'd been. I wasn't going to tell anybody how much I'd drunk. I wasn't sure what time I'd got home. I had to listen to the radio to see if there'd been any hit and runs. I didn't know if I'd hit anything. The blackouts were more frequent. My promises were broken. I had some really hilarious experiences, but at the time they were tragic. I can remember once trying to fly from New Zealand to Hawaii. We used to go up there quite a lot. And I made a right mess of myself on the plane. It was on the jumbo jet. They took me up to the lounge. They tried to pacify me. The captain came along with little trinkets to try to quieten me down. They did everything but tie me down. And the next thing I remember, I am lying flat on my back on a tiled floor with a circle of large, dark ladies in muumuus looking at me. Now, I was on the ground in a toilet in Western Samoa, and I had no recollection of getting off the plane, and to this day I have no recollection of getting back on the plane. But I must have passed out in the toilet on the way. I was in the wrong country, for God's sake. Another time we tried to fly from Los Angeles to Hawaii, and we were going to go to one of the smaller islands. I've forgotten what it's called. I think it's Hilo. Is there Hilo? Yep. And the plane, we got pissed in the airport at Los Angeles because the flight was late. The plane went down to Hilo, landed, took off, and I slept through it. So I still haven't seen that island. My laughter became different as my drinking progressed. I laughed at people. I put people down by laughing. I became a scathing, nasty person. The last couple of years of my life, done that one. The last couple of years of my drinking, there was no laughter. There was no laughter. There was nothing left. There was nothing left. I couldn't remember. I wouldn't admit I couldn't remember. I went out to dinners. I abused people. I couldn't remember. I was told about it. It doesn't get any better. It doesn't get any better. I came through the doors of AA and I can remember my first meeting. This is a wonderful, wonderful fellowship when you get people who are so different who come together with a common cause. At that first meeting there was women who were older than me. I was only in my early 30s. There was a man from Wales, naturally called Taffy. He worked on the oil rigs in New Zealand. There was a retired High Court judge. There were a whole lot of different people. What do I remember about that meeting? The laughter. People were laughing, and it was a different sort of laughter. It was not the laughter that I'd had for the last two or three really sick years. They welcomed me back the next week. Now, that hadn't happened for a while. One of the old-timers, after about 3 weeks, said, "Oh, it's nice to see you, girlie. You're looking good." I thought I looked pretty good when I came in. There must have been some room for improvement. A lot of things were different. You sat in a meeting and you didn't interrupt people. I hadn't ever done that in my life. You listened. I hadn't done that for years. You got home early. I hadn't done that for years. I couldn't believe it. You went out and got home at 9 or 9.30. Didn't know people did it. I drank for 17 years. I did a lot of damage. And I realised fairly early on it wasn't going to take me 17 weeks or 17 months to get well. I'm still getting well. I've slowly learned to laugh again, but I've learned to laugh with people. I have a very, very happy life. I've got another little bit here from the big book, from Alcoholics Anonymous, page 132. We think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience out of the past. But why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered and have helped others to recover. What greater cause could there be for rejoicing than this? Today laughter plays a big part in my life. Actually, I think I'm on my honeymoon. We got married in February and didn't have time for a honeymoon. And my husband is the one who's asleep at the back of the room over there. We've been married now for nearly 5 months. We met in the fellowship 25 years ago. And he has a wonderful... He has a wonderful, wonderful knack of diffusing any aggro that might be rising up in me. He just says something that makes me laugh. And it's gone. It is just awesome. Today I can turn negatives into positives. I've practiced that art. And gosh, that helps with living. Do you know when you smile, it's more difficult to be depressed or even upset? So if you're happy, tell your face. Let me leave you with this. Today will be as good a day as you decide to make it. So let's go out and have a good one. Thank you.
Glasses have been claimed. There we go. Whoa. I still have the tissues for crying. Okay. Jeannie, thank you. Thank you very much. You make women look good in sobriety. Thanks again. Our next speaker, we're moving right along here quite quickly here. You know, there's a lot of discussion about the first meeting I'm hearing today. You know, I remember my first meeting, and I have to tell you, I didn't pick to go there. I didn't get up and decide I wanted to go to AA. I was tricked into going to it. I get dressed up. I wore this green felt hat with a big peacock feather, a matching velour jacket, Calvin Klein jeans, and designer boots. My first meeting was in Honolulu, and it was about 99 degrees, but I looked good, so I thought. I had a hangover that walked in the room before me. He was coming in clear across the room. They had all these guys outside hugging and kissing and rubbing up again, so happy to see me, and I was so unhappy to see them. So if there's anybody here for their first meeting today, and you feel that way, I want to welcome you. You know, it is a program of laughter, and our next speaker is from Marietta, Ohio. Let's give a warm welcome to Bill F. from Ohio.
Woo! My name's Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. I want to say tonight, I'm a nighttime person. I don't know if anybody out here is like that, but I love for the night. There's somebody signaling me over there. Nighttime. Another two people. Three. Oh, what a beautiful time I've been having. And gosh, the speakers were great. I had to, I'm missing the bubbles. I really love the bubbles. I thought they were coming out of the ceiling, and I haven't had anything to drink. Somebody explain to me about how they made those bubbles. That's fascinating, because I love bubbles, you know. And I always wanted to speak somewhere where they had bubbles. And my dream came true when I got to speak at an eating meeting, because I've always wanted to speak somewhere where they had food. So that's two of my dreams that have come true since I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never thought for a minute when I sat down and had my first drink that I would ever be with this many people in my entire life, just beyond me. And something that attracted me, and I've heard both the speakers, Jeannie and Vic both say it, was the laughter. That's what brought me in this room, because I forgot about myself for 1 second, and that must have just been enough for me to catch on to this thing. It was the laughter. Because you know what I thought? I thought Alcoholics Anonymous were some people sitting in a church basement holding on to some wine bottles, and they had some candles lit, and they were saying, "I ain't never going to drink again." That's what I thought it was. And I heard a guy get up, my first meeting, a tall, skinny fella, and he said, "I'm a grateful alcoholic. I could have died." And everybody started laughing and clapping and cheering. Then they passed the basket, and I thought, they're taking up a collection for me. I was so happy. And they didn't give me the money. And my next thought was, they were going to buy some pot with it. I thought that was what this was all about. And I came for a little while before somebody said, "Bill, we don't smoke pot in AA." And they said it to me in such a wonderful way. I was sitting in the back of one of those wide-track Oldsmobiles on a leather seat. It seemed as big as this room. It was like I was riding on a sofa. And I was asked, "What are you going to do tonight when you get home?" And it was this real tall, attractive black woman. She was beautiful. She looked like Diana Ross to me. And she was all dressed up. And she had been the speaker that night at the meeting. And she said, "Bill, what are you going to do tonight?" I said, "Carolyn, I'm going to smoke some pot. How about you?" I thought she was trying to make a date with me. And folks, that took a lot of courage. Because I wasn't a person that liked to bathe. And I started out my first meeting dressed up in a nice coat and tie. And I had to go back to do a little more research. And when I came back, I was wearing a pair of shorts.
One leg cut off here and one down here.
And I'm the inventor of Birkenstock sandals. I wore them year-round, even in the snow or in the winter. And I also invented backpacks. We've been seeing those here. I carried beer in my backpack. And I invented the cut-off sweatshirt and the beard. And I was living with a gal from Newark, New Jersey, in Yellow Springs, Ohio. She was a fellow college student like me. Don't get any ideas. I don't have a lot of years of sobriety. I just was an old student. And we were living in this three-bedroom apartment. And she used to put me in the bathtub and scrub me. And then she'd brush my teeth. And it was a few months before Carolyn asked me about our date that I'd taken a bath or brushed my teeth. And I came from a good alcoholic home. And I'd had responsible employment. And I drank my way through it. And I got to tell you, there were a little wreckage on the way in the past. I was married to a nice gal I met at the hospital I worked at. They had hired me at the hospital because I had told them I worked at an Army hospital in Virginia. And I did work at an Army hospital in Virginia. But what I didn't tell them was that I wasn't a corpsman. I was a janitor at the hospital. And this hospital put me to work in their emergency room late at night, from 11 at night to 8 in the morning. And my job was to go get the nurse or the doctor if somebody came in. This was a small city. And I put on that nice uniform, one of those green scrub suits, and I became a doctor. Some nights I got the doctor, the nurse, some nights I didn't. And I had a pretty good time. But that's where I met my first wife. And we got married, and she wanted to have a family. And, you know, I was thinking about my money and about drinking and having a good time. And I managed to convince her that we needed to start with a dog. So we adopted an Irish setter. And at that time, I was taking the Canadian Mist experiment. And someone had told me that if I drank Canadian Mist, I wouldn't get sick and I wouldn't get hungover. And I tried it for 2 years. It does not work. I got just as sick and just as drunk drinking Canadian Mist. And anyway, I would be drinking late at night, and my wife went to work, and I started drinking with the dog. And I would mix him a drink. He had a little aluminum bowl. And I would get to talking to him. He only drank it with Coca-Cola, and that's not a plug for Coke. And I'd get down there with him, and I'd drink it right out of the bowl with him. Being a night person, I like to tell him about my problems. I got lonely, and I talked over all my problems with the dog. I'd be drinking right out of that bowl with him. And one night, it was just about Christmas. And I looked over, and we had a house with a glass wall, beautiful home. And there was my neighbor unloading his Christmas tree. And, of course, the dog had to answer the call of nature, so I let him out. And out he ran. I looked out there, and there was my neighbor and the dog in this tree. They were tugging. The dog had locked his jaws right on the end of that tree, and they were pulling back and forth. And like a good neighbor, I ran out there and I said, "Hey, neighbor, is he bothering you?" And he said, "No, but he smells like he's been drinking." This is a neighborhood disease. There's no doubt about it. I don't know who became the worst alcoholic, me or the dog. You never know. But I found myself, after that marriage dissolved, and I came home and found one of those notes that we all find. "I'm leaving you. I can't stand this. I can't take this anymore." And she took everything that was paid for. And off I went. And I ended up, after drinking my way out of a good, responsible job, and I got to tell you, on the way, they offered me at the hospital I worked at to go into the treatment center. It was on the second floor. And I went up there every day and drew blood and talked to the patients and bummed cigarettes from them and talked with the pretty nurses. And they said, "We know you have a drinking problem." And I'll tell you, I don't know about you, when I drank that stuff, it came right out of my pores when I drank. Every time I belch, I smelled like a distillery. And they put me on the lemonade diet for a while. Every Christmas party, they said, "Serve Bill lemonade." And you don't know what that's like. Because I wanted to drink. That's what I thought about all the time. I had a mental obsession to drink. And a physical allergy to alcohol. But I had no idea that was the problem. Anyway, I happened to be going through this lemonade experience. And I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went down to the meeting. It was an 8:30 meeting right in the basement of that hospital. And there was a fellow up there talking. And I came in with my shirt and tie and my sport coat, my briefcase and my beeper, and sat in the very back row. And I remember the speaker up there saying, "All we have to do is help other alcoholics." And I got up and left there. And I knew there was a nurse up on the third floor that needed help. So I made a date with her. And we went to a little beer joint in Dayton. And I was sitting and telling her about how I was from AA and I was going to help her. And the waitress came by and she said, "What do you have?" And I ordered a tequila sunrise. So I was off and going again. And that job was gone. But I do have to tell you, those nice people said to me, "If you want help, you're an alcoholic, Bill, you can go to the treatment center right up on the second floor." This was in 1978. And they said, "What you do, you come in, you're on the clock, you go through treatment, you're done with treatment, then you can go home." I would have been the first outpatient alcoholism treatment patient in the history, and I missed that. I could have been the very first outpatient. Anyway, I ended up in a small town. I was living with a gal, 3-bedroom house. She was bathing me. I was stealing everything I could get on. I like to write bad checks. I like Victor. We can share an experience. I loved writing bad checks. I had had a checking account. Every cash register in the little place I lived said, "Don't take a check from Bill." Anyway, I did have a checking account at one time. But what I like to do was get those checks that were on the little islands and write them. And I said to myself, "Someday I'm going to pay this all back." And I can tell you, thanks to steps 8 and 9, I have completed those payments finally. I thought a check was just a promise to pay in the future, and it's true. What happened was, in this small town, could you believe this, how the power of God is so great, that I wrote those checks, and the bank called my parents in Parkersburg, West Virginia, and my parents made good on those checks. Isn't that something? If not, I would still be in prison today. And I never gave it a thought, because I love to drink. I love to drink more than I like to do anything in the world. I got to tell you this. I was living in this house, and we moved in there. I didn't have any money. I used to take money out of this gal's purse when she would leave. And I guess she got wise to it, because the day she went to work in the bar, she took her purse with her. I happened to be in the basement, and I saw this huge pile of pop bottles. And there was a time you used to be able to take bottles and get money back on them. I felt like I had found a gold mine when I saw that pile of bottles. That's how bad I wanted to drink. So I walked down to the store about 4 blocks and got one of those metal carts and I pushed it up. You know when you're shaky and you want a drink and you're pushing a grocery cart and there's holes and you're steering all over and you go off the curb and into the street. And I kept trying, and I got back there with the cart, and I took it, lugged it down the steps to the basement, and filled that cart up. I thought I was in heaven. I was thinking a nickel for every one of those bottles. I loaded the cart. It was heaping over the top, up the steps, and I broke a few bottles, and I began to get resentful and angry and fearful. How will I drink if I break any more of these bottles? Up the steps, pushed it all the way down the street and broke a few more bottles and got upset and cussed and kicked the cart. Cursed, carried on, pushed the cart four blocks, and I got down there. And this young stock clerk, he must have been about 17, he had a big white apron on and a ball cap. And, buddy, we don't take bottles no more. We're doing plastic today. I left that grocery cart with bottles there. And I left. And that was one more reason why I'm in this room today. Just think about that. And that was a daily thing for me. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I set out here what I thought about when I got here, and they said, get a sponsor. I wanted a good-looking blonde, tall, slim. And lucky for me, a fellow was looking after me and said, no. And he instructed me to sit in the front row. And that's where I sat. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous and those fellows that looked after me. Anyway, on our way here, because this has been a wonderful adventure, my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, my wife and I were riding. Sharon, where are you at? I took my bedroll and moved in with Sharon, and she found sobriety. Well, maybe she left. Good God. My inspiration. Well, I better talk about my sponsor. She's right there. Stand up, honey. I love you, sweetheart. We were driving up to the border, you know, the checkpoint, and I read that sign, no weapons allowed in Canada. That's all I could think about. I just had that in my mind. And so they asked their question, do you have anything to declare? Do you have any contraband? And I looked up and I told the border guard, we don't have any weapons. And she burst into laughter. I'm still a little off sometimes. The other morning I got up and I started reading the toothpaste tube. I don't know. And I get into a strange city, I'll read the phone book. I'm still a little off base sometimes. But thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And the laughter's what did it, you know. And I'll tell you, there's been tears too. And thank God for the tears too. It makes it all worth it. I came here convicted felon, and you could just guess why. I could tell you this story, but I'm going to slip on that. But I got to tell you this about the miracle, because this is what it is the miracle. After 10 years of sobriety, I went to Montgomery County Common Pleas Court, and the judge told me, you've been here before, and I'm not going to grant your request to have your record expunged. And my wife said, why didn't you argue with him? We left. And I got home the next day, and the phone rang, and it was the court bailiff. And he said, we made a mistake. And because of him granting me that petition, I've been able to go back and have useful, productive work. And that's a miracle. And the laughter makes it a miracle. Thank you very much.